Challenges are all around us, at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series, we talk with people in our community who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Josh King, professor of English at Baylor and founding director of the Environmental Humanities minor in the College of Arts and Sciences, discusses how 19th century poetry opened up a world of environmental justice and food access work in the heart of Waco. Hosting today's conversation is KWBU's Community Engagement Coordinator, Rachel Velasco. This conversation was recorded June 14th in the KWBU studio.
Well, Josh, welcome to the studio today. It's such a pleasure to have you joining us for our Central Texas Leadership Series. So I just want to get started by you just tell us a little bit about what you do at Baylor.
Sure. So I'm a professor of English at Baylor, and I focus on literature, religion, and the environment, how those all come together, particularly in the 19th century in Britain. That's my area of focus in scholarship and teaching. And out of that set of passions has come a new program at Baylor called the Environmental Humanities, where we're basically asking how do the things the humanities care about, imagination, stories, history, ethics, philosophy, religion, all those things inform our relationship to the environment. So that's a program that I've been very excited to start, and it began actually this last fall.
I would love for you to talk a little bit more about this, just broadly, the intersection of the humanities with this idea of environmental justice, because I feel like that's such an interesting thing that maybe we aren't super familiar with.
I mean,
I'm not in academia, but, you know, I try to stay familiar with what's going on. And that sort of perspective is kind of a new one for me, and I suspect maybe for our listeners as well. So can you elaborate a little bit on what that means for
us? Absolutely. So if you think about what motivates our actions as human beings, it's how we imagine our place in the world, how we understand what we understand the world to be, and that very much directs the way we're going to use our resources, the way we're going to shape our environments, whose environments are going to be privileged or not, and their care. So the stories that shape our minds, our imaginations, the poems, right, that we read. The media that we consume, the histories that we've been taught, all those things, often before we've even taken a step, have guided our actions, right, and have given us a sense of what's possible. So the environmental humanities are really about digging into how do stories and media, worship practices even, the histories that have become conscious and important to us, how do those guide our actions in the environment, in the world, in the natural world, and even shape what we understand nature to be in the first place, right? So it's really important to get to those if we're going to have any kind of real, holistic, and sustained solution to the problems facing us.
I think that's such a timely thing to be focusing on, right? Because we hear a lot about environmental crisis and what's happening. And even now, you know, we're having these strange weather patterns and everybody's going, I don't remember the weather being like this. And so just at a basic level, I think we have an understanding that there is change happening. And then to put the lens of what we're humans and how historically and then also in the present moment, how are we interacting and interfacing with that? I think it's really a fascinating conversation to have in light of what's happening currently in our world. And so this work that you're doing is so poignant, I think. And so I, you know, when we first talked about, hey, I'd love to have you come on and talk about this, it was because you were actively working in a community garden at Baylor. And I found out about that and I said, oh, I want to hear more about what's going on. And that's when this sort of whole broad perspective opened up. So can you talk a little bit about now how you're applying in the physical way here in Waco this idea of what environmental justice through the lens of humanities really actually tangibly could look like?
Right. That's very important for us. Something that you'll find in the just to give a kind of a little bit of background, the environmental humanities as a kind of area of focus within the academy is actually fairly new, about 20 years, that it's really become more of a recognized area of inquiry and study and teaching and research. So what it's always had as a major component is it's very important not to have these discussions simply in a classroom. They have to have real world impact and connection. And students need to be able to make that connection within their educational experience so that it then transforms how they go and live in future communities, right, and shape the professions they'll be going into. So the community garden at Baylor, it's right at the corner of Baylor's campus at 9th and James. So pretty close to places like the Armstrong Browning Library, if people are familiar with that. So a stone's throw away from Central Campus. It's been there for a while, but COVID came, dashed it to pieces, and the aftermath, the environmental humanities with some other partners, the city of Waco, several nonprofits, has been part of a group called the Sustainable Community and Regenerative Agriculture Project, SCRAP.
SCRAP. I'm familiar with SCRAP, yep.
And that group has been trying to promote environmental justice in the form of access to healthy food. And of course, that involves healing the environments by which our food is produced. And it also addresses food waste, which is a major source of emissions with methane in landfills that contributes to our climate problem. So we have this kind of wicked problem, as the term is often used, like one that's really difficult and hard, where we are throwing away a lot of our food, about 40% in the United States. And that's going into landfills, and the way that breaks down in a landfill under pressure. There's science behind it, but just the basic idea is that creates a lot of methane emissions, and that's even more potent than carbon dioxide in creating our climate problem. The communities that are bearing the brunt of those problems in our city are those communities that are also under-resourced historically and present. Environmental justice is a particular area of inquiry the environmental humanities involves. And what that has to do with is the fact that not all people have equal access to healthy and flourishing environments, and that there are historical reasons why that's the case and systems that keep that disparity in place. So what this project's trying to do is to help students understand that within the classroom, but then also contribute tangibly to a different and more equitable local flourishing food system that is redirecting food waste away from the landfill into gardens like the Baylor Community Garden through composting. Happy to talk about what that is. And then growing healthy food for those who have limited access to it. So that's something that we've been doing from across disciplines in the Baylor Community Garden in particular. It's just been amazing to see what's happened within just a year.
So my first immediate question is, how does a Harvard-educated PhD in literature with a focus in Victorian literature, how do you make that leap into this really tangible, hands-on environmental justice work? Like, walk me through that story, because I know there's a story in there.
As everything, it begins with poetry for me. One of my favorite poets is Gerard Manley Hopkins. He was a Victorian, so 19th century, later 19th century priest and poet, Catholic priest and poet. And in several of his poems, but I'll just quote a line from one of them, a poem called God's Grandeur, which is amongst my favorite. He has a line that can seem almost like a throwaway, but it gestures to a kind of seismic shift that was taking place in how people related to soil and agriculture because of the British Empire. And what the line says is, the soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. Shod is a word for like a heavy work boot, right? And so there's the barrier between our feet and the ground. We're disconnected from the creation we're in, and earth we're part of, and the soil has been stripped bare. There's a whole story that refers to, really, that's taking place in his time. Britain had become a major empire. Obviously, over the 19th century, expanded that territory immensely and drove its own food production in large part by stealing nutrients from around the world from other people's land, by erasing ecosystems in places as far-flung as, you know, New Zealand and Australia, to make way for mass beef and cattle production to sustain a hugely growing appetite for that at home. So you're literally having the soils of the world stripped bare, right? The soil is bare now. It's woven into every line of poetry, if you look carefully, these kind of changes that we are now inheriting. So I think to understand where we are, you need to sort of see where we've been. And the kind of global food system that Britain helped to create the architecture of, it's kept going, sadly, where many areas of the world bear the brunt of fewer people who are consuming more, right? And it's leaving behind a world in which now one-third of the soil already in our planet is degraded in its ability to sustain crops and healthy food because of these practices. So it's a direct connection for me.
Wow. I think that hearing you talk about poetry as an impetus for action, I mean, that's a totally new idea for me. And maybe for a lot of folks, you know, you think you pick up a book of poetry or a novel or something and it's for entertainment, right? I just, like, entertain me. Let me feel something different.
Yeah.
But to look at it through the lens of there's justice to be found, there's perspectives to be seen, that's why this is so fascinating to me, and how you've been able to make that leap from academia and really the study of the past and the influences and how these things came to pass to now, well, let's turn that into something that we can share with others. So talk to me about your work with these students, because, you know, I think sometimes leaders get sort of like, okay, well, I'm here doing something. How is this really going to work? Like, what can we really do? How can we really make an impact? And what has that process been like for you working with students in this way?
Yeah, it's just been absolutely enheartening, just really, really encouraging. So just a couple concrete examples might help. One class that I teach is on literature and environmental justice. And so we are looking at how literature of the last couple hundred years up to our present moment bears witness to the kind of unequal suffering of environments and communities, right? Major concern of environmental justice. And a huge through line for that class is a focus on unequal food systems and their environmental impact, right? The damage to the land and to communities. So an example being one that I just mentioned from Hopkins's poem. And so even as we're looking at this, we're also looking at poems about community gardens, poems about regenerative agriculture, about healing of community, novels that bear witness to the suffering and also to the resilience of people who are suffering the brunt of these challenges. So they're getting that conceptually. But then we are all through the semester in the community garden at Baylor, and then working with partners in this scrap project at their sites, helping with their projects. Everything from, for example, one group of students helping to create the beds in a garden that is in East Waco by Global Revive, which is a wonderful Kay Bell. Give a shout out to her, amazing person in the Scrap Collective. That's now, because of her group, really become a thriving garden that's sustaining food in the community that had been on a previously abandoned lot. So it's not just the Baylor Community Garden, it's also partners within the community that we've been involved in. That's one class. There are now, as a result of some seminars I've done at Baylor with support of the school, 19 to more classes that have been created to further this work. So it's been really exciting.
Yeah, to hear how you've taken it off of Baylor's campus and really become a partner in the greater Waco community, I think is so encouraging, because one of the things that I see when I'm out in the community talking to people is there's a real hunger and a want for collaboration and a real hunger to do things that are making a collective positive impact in our community. And to see that coming literally off the page and being brought to life is a really exciting thing. And I love that our listeners are getting to hear a real world example of how that's coming to pass right here in Waco. But I'd like to hear from you also. What do you see the long-term impact of this? Like, what would you like to see the long-term impact be? How would you like to see this grow? What kind of change do you think is possible through programs like this?
Oh, yeah. I've just been so encouraged within. So real quick, you know, we've got some grant funding that has helped a lot with this. And that especially is taking place in the last year. Here's what has happened just in that last year and just at the Baylor Community Garden. I can mention so many different examples. 808 people, students, staff, faculty have been involved in that work. 500 pounds of healthy produce have been grown just in the last couple of months there to go to Baylor's food pantry for food insecure students. And now we're hoping that will go beyond and into the community as well. That's an example of what can happen when faculty and students, staff all collaborate together on this one little piece, right?
Right.
But that's one picture of a much larger change that is happening also with this scrap collective across the community. So my dream is that this becomes more of a campus and community ecosystem where we have a flourishing ecosystem of gardens and composting, classes being involved in that project, that process from multiple disciplines. We have people interested in this in everything from literature, of course, to if you would believe it, modern foreign languages, to land use law. I mean, there's so many different ways you can bring in disciplines to help with this work. And to see that as really becoming part of the way that Baylor operates, the way we think of our land at Baylor and creating more spaces on campus that are similar to the Baylor Community Garden so that students just have this as part of the fabric of their lives as their education. And we are nourishing that in the wider community too.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do the students say when they're a part of this? Like, what kind of experiences have they had? Like, what are they telling you? Because I have a feeling that many of them, this is the first time that they've even really had an understanding of what food injustice is or what, you know, environmental justice could potentially look like or even like that it's an issue. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, like, what have their responses been?
I think it's been so important that it's not only, it's been on one hand, yes, a kind of sense of passion, right, to contribute to a better, more equitable world on one hand. That's just so important. There's also something that's so profoundly healing in being actively involved in that. I've had so many students saying that it feels restorative simply to have their hands in the soil and know that that's contributing to, and eventually, you know, healthy food for other people in the community. One thing I think in our current moment, and I'll tell a quick story about this, two stories, one on the hardship, one on the hope.
Yep.
I think that with programs like this, where we are emphasizing inequities in the environment and the major problems facing us, this is something that's also coming all around, you know, through the news, and more students are growing up with this at an early age than before. It's more a part of their education and awareness. With that can paradoxically come, with greater awareness, paralysis, a sense of that the problems are so immense and complex, there's very little I can do, and I've just got to sort of huddle here and try to make it through and feel depressed.
Right. Right, yeah.
I, early into this work, have had students, when they've become more aware of these problems, I remember one in particular coming to my office and just weeping, feeling like that she's coming up into a world in which the problems are so intense. And there seems to be so little to do on her part.
Yeah.
By contrast, when you can feel that in the soil where you are learning and standing, right, your community, you are contributing to a difference and you're seeing that, it empowers agency and possibility in the minds of students. So quick story on that.
Wow.
One student from that literature environmental justice class was in student government. I'll give him a shout out, Jackson Woodruff. And became so, you know, devoted to these kind of things that we're doing at the garden and in the community that it had secured funding to make some major, from student government, to make some major improvements to the garden, including a carbon-absorbing mural that's going to be there, a new greenhouse. That's just one picture. There could be many other stories of how students, when they begin to get a sense of their agency and involvement in these concerns, they start finding creative ways to draw upon resources at the university to make sustainable transformations. So to me, that's just one of the greatest and most delightful things to witness.
I think there's so much hope in that, right? When you can change a single person's perspective, then there's like that ripple effect that's possible.
Totally.
And so what is the possibility? You know, we don't know, but it starts with just an individual thing. And I think hearing the perspectives of these young people who are getting an opportunity to do something that could really potentially change their worldview, their life, the way that they interact with their fellow person, however their life ends up. You know, they may not end up doing community gardens forever,
totally. Yeah.
but they're going to take those experiences. That, I feel like, is the heart of what leadership is all about. It's giving people opportunities to learn something about themselves that they can now harness and make their world a little bit better. And so I want to hear from you, like, did you have people that were sort of pouring that into you before you sort of stepped into this role as like a connector of people? How did that come about for you?
You know, I think there have been people along the way who have helped with that. But an early influence, not directly in environmental concerns, but seeing how that type of approach to leadership can be so generative, bring together people from across all kinds of disciplines and areas of focus into a common work, and then seeing the amazing generative results that can come from that. One person who helped me experience that, but in a slightly different way, was a man named Jerry Eisley, who founded something called the Washington Arts Group in Washington, D.C. When I was finishing college, I went to work with them for a year, and they did all kinds of amazing things around the world, exhibits in St. Petersburg with, you know, helping to bring light to orphanages and all kinds of things, just really powerful work. So seeing how he could work with artists and people involved in the city and, you know, in certain cases, we were doing work in like Anacostia, a challenged area of Washington, D.C., with church leaders and school teachers there, bringing them all together for some amazing projects that resulted. That, I think, gave me this early taste. Okay, you know, I want to do my area of interest and specialty, but I've got to always be looking for how do you make those connections with people who are doing parallel work, different field, different resources, and then how do they come together?
Yeah, that idea where we don't live in isolation.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just put yourself up in a tower and do one thing your whole life. It really does come down to those connections. And so, you know, that said, you are running this program. Mm-hmm. In fact, you founded the minor that's mm-hmm. available at Baylor mm-hmm. in environmental
humanities.
Yeah. Thank you. And so this is something new that you're bringing forth. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that by stepping forward and pushing these ideas forward, how do you feel like that is being, I'm trying to find the word that I'd like to, like, how do you feel like the other leaders around you are responding to that? So, like, are you finding support with other mm-hmm. leaders? Are you able to, how do you feed yourself, I guess, is really what I'm, like, that was an odd way to get there. But that's the idea is, like, you know, when you're stepping out in something and it's new and there's challenges there, like, how are you supporting yourself?
Yeah. Well, I think it's through the community that results, right? I think sometimes we can say words like ecology and ecosystem, for example, and forget that their root is in oikos, which is pointing to relationships within a household.
Oh, wow.
Right? So that's how we can think of the environment working through multitude of relationships materially. The same thing happens, I think, with meaningful good work of this kind. And so it's the kind of community and the ecosystem, really, that's that kind of household of relationships, you could say, that's formed between myself and other faculty who've been involved in the environmental humanities there. In addition to myself, 16 faculty who are affiliated now with that program from across the university, many more who are involved. And it's through the collaboration with them that I'm constantly renewed in ideas of what we can be doing. For example, I could mention so many, but one person who's been involved is French professor Jake Abel. He happens to have skill with hosting community film festivals.
Okay.
So, you know, an idea that's coming out of that is doing a green film festival that might happen at Baylor. So I could go on and on about all the different examples like that. And what's so encouraging is when you see people bringing their own interests and skill sets into it, it becomes much bigger than yourself. And so you're always renewed by a sense of expanding possibility and and given your own creativity is, you know, is energized.
I love that idea of a household that you mentioned.
Yes.
Like everybody has a role to play.
Yes.
And that makes the whole thing function.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful way to think about the work that you do and also the world that we live in.
Totally.
So just kind of as we wrap things up here, what is exciting to you about the future, and what do you have in the pipeline? I know I saw that you're working on a book,
mm-hmm.
so maybe talk a little bit about that and what you see in the next year for Josh.
Okay. So a couple things. So that book that you mentioned, it's connected to a bunch of different articles and things I've also been doing. but it's called The Body of Christ, The Body of the Earth. And it's looking at how 19th century poets from different religious perspectives imagines the church, the body of Christ, but also Christ himself as in solidarity with the rest of creation, the rest of the natural world. And what we can learn from that, from poets who were living through a moment of profound disruption and really destruction to those relationships through the British Empire. So that is something I'm very excited to continue to work on. There's also the importance of changing the way we actually structure academic, conferencing and relationships that drive research. So I'm also in the midst of right now directing a kind of year-long project co-directing with a team called Event 2024, which is a flightless conference that's saving a lot of carbon by having 17 institutions around the world all involved and hosting micro conferences, but then they're digitally connected with events all through the year and a database for sharing papers and commenting on them through multimedia. It's been really exciting. So that's something that's also going on alongside the work with Environmental Humanities, but then the Water Academy that's sort of trying to provide a paradigm for how do we continue our work across the globe without at the same time contributing to the endangerment of our common home.
Yeah. Right? That's a fascinating way to tie it together. I feel like a lot of that came out of what we were forced to do during the pandemic.
Totally.
And then now it's like, okay, there's a recognition of there's value here in reevaluating the way that we approach certain things that we kind of take for granted.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really great way to think about what the future could be.
Mm-hmm.
The last question, and we'll make this one really brief. You know, I would just love to hear from you. Mm-hmm. What is it that lights you up in a day? Like, what makes you feel joy? And I know a lot of it comes from your work, but just, you know, on a personal level, you are a person who speaks with so much joy in your voice and so much connection and kindness. So what are the things that make you happy?
Mm. I mean, so much of it is tied, obviously, to the things we've been talking about. You know, a phrase that has been going through my mind the last month, especially for different reasons, is part of a verse from the letter to the Ephesians by Paul. And it says, we are members one of another. And I think that has been something I've witnessed in so many different ways, you know, through this work and through teaching, through research, environmental humanities, these collaborative projects. So to me, it is the beautiful and the more amazing things that can happen when we recognize that reality and live into it.
That is such a beautiful way to end our time together. Josh, I want to thank you so much for coming and spending this time talking with me. You know, you have just a light that shines, and I hope that the little bit of that light came through the airwaves today. I know that's a weird way to think about radio, but it really has been a joy to talk with you, and I just wanted to thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much.
This episode of the Central Texas Leadership Series was recorded in the KWBU studios on June 14th. You can listen to this episode again and hear other episodes on our website at kwbu.org.